Hey, folks, this episode doesn't have too much to do with the First World War, but it was really fun to do. My great friend Jake has been asking me to do this for a while, saying that the BFWWP community doesn't know enough about me personally. So we got together and made it happen. In this talk, we discuss the podcast, some stuff about World War I, myself and my background, and the current war in Ukraine. In the interest of full disclosure, I served in the U.S. Army, but did not deploy to Iraq or Afghanistan. This episode was originally released on Patreon, but I wanted to release it here as a gift to my buddy Jake. I hope you folks out there enjoy it. Merry Christmas, Jake. And 2023, man, we are walking your dad's battlefields in France.
Let's rock.
All right, so everything we say now is recorded. So just so you know.
I'm new at this.
I'm relatively untrained. So
you've done a bunch of podcasts.
Yeah. Okay.
Let me ask, how did you get into all this before we start? I'm Jake and I followed your show. I stumbled onto it because I got into World War One. I went, who is this guy? And then I contacted you and you were kind enough to get in touch. So we become, I think, pretty good friends as a result. Well, I hope so.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Yeah. Is this the part where I'd be like, I don't actually like Jake at all. So
that's all right. Yeah, you'd fit into another subgroup, but that's okay. Well, anyway, as you can hear, we get along great.
Yes.
How old are you?
Me?
Yeah.
I am 44, man.
44. I am 69, November 28th. Now, we've got this wide disparity in ages, but we're both into World War One. How does that happen?
So I'll back up a second. So, folks, as you can tell, we are well into this conversation, and we're doing something different. So this is Jake, a good friend of mine, listener of the podcast, as you guys have heard already. Jake is a supporter on Patreon, and one of the perks he gets, of course, I mean, he wouldn't have to just be a supporter on Patreon, but I would do this anyways. But he gets to interview me rather than me doing the interviewing, which is...
This is not an interview. This is a conversation.
Yeah, man. So that's what's happening, folks. We just kind of rolled. I just hit the record button and we just started going. All right. So question, like, why am I into World War One? Especially like in the last 9 years when I start, you know, since I've been doing podcasting, I'm increasingly ever more fascinated by it. And I'm fascinated by the events of the conflict, so much of which I still don't know. So learning everything is like, it's really cool, but also seeing like the bigger trends, like the reverberations throughout world history that are still happening today. And being able to tie a lot of that stuff back to like World War One, I find it fascinating. Like, it's really what's up?
It's really fascinating. And I was sort of the same way, cause I grew up on a military base in Germany. Mm-hmm. In 1963, which is not that long after World War One, but as a kid, everything was so. I'm living in Stuttgart, and my high school was Ernst Röhm's headquarters, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Really inundated. So we'd go to antique stores, and I don't know if you can see, this is the very first antique I ever bought for 25 cents, one Deutschmark. And it's a 1914 Iron Cross. First class. I ended up getting thrown out of that antique store because I opened a drawer that was more or less, you say, World War II history, and they were but I did get the Iron Cross. But I was thinking, what really will set the background for World War One is this TV show on Netflix called The Empress. And it's about the woman that married, you know, Franz Ferdinand, that got shot by the guy that led to this, that led to this, that somehow seems to be going on again. So.
Right, right. Yeah. Man, just for me, I mean, it was, I mean, so like I think I've said before on other podcasts, like for me, it was a music video. It was the rock band Metallica. They had a song called One. And in their music video, they used clips from the movie Johnny Got His Gun.
Talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I got into it. I was like, what is this? Like Johnny Got His Gun. And then I found out it was a book. I always enjoyed reading. And man, it was a book of, you know, it was a story that took place, you know, after World War One. And I just like dove into it as a kid. And then, of course,
Sutherland.
Say again.
Donald Sutherland, the actor.
Who played Jesus in.
Yeah, one of his first roles with his long hair screaming out of the train. Well, it's funny you should mention music as what got you into World War One. As a kid, I don't know if you remember Snoopy versus the Red Baron, Charles Schulz.
Yeah.
One of my favorite cartoonists as a kid, right? So I write him saying, send me a picture of the Red Baron or Snoopy being chased by the Red Baron. And he did send it, but I don't know if it was a mimeograph sheet, but I had it. And the song that got me into it was the Royal Guardsman playing Snoopy versus the Red Baron. And this was in 1960. I can tell Snoopy came out in the First World War. And it was a number one hit. So anyway, so I got into the movie, The Blue Max and all these others. And, you know, then something happened in movies. And that's when I saw Johnny Got His Gun. Well, before, and then I watched Paths of Glory and Johnny Got His Gun. That was hardcore. And that made you go, hey, wait a second. You know, World War One was hardcore premium strength. And you watch Paths of Glory by Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah.
Who, I mean, he was brilliant. And Kirk Douglas really in a great role. I mean, Kubrick and Douglas and Trumbo had such a great relationship that they ended up doing Spartacus together, which is nothing like World War One, of course. But
no,
as you can see, I got my degree in history after I got my degree in film. So I kind of merged the two together. But, and I want to ask you something that you and I have talked about.
Mm-hmm.
11/11/11. I think Veterans Day is much more of a World War One commemoration. But, I mean, if it was 11/11/11/11 o'clock, why wouldn't you just go the day before at midnight? I mean, why? I know pomp and circumstance of the time, but I'd hate to be that guy at 10:45. Of course, I would have hated to be the very first guy.
Right, right, right. Oh, man. So I need to that's something that like I can't answer because like I don't know why they chose like 11 o'clock. God, I've always just kind of taken it for granted.
Yeah, I would just thought of that last night and I went, wait a second, because I was thinking, well, why commemorate the very last guy like in All Quiet on the Western Front? Why not commemorate the guy in the beginning, the second guy, that nurse over here? Mm-hmm. And then, God, it was such a crazy war. And then I wanted to ask.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a fantastic book. It's on my shelf right there. It's No Man's Land by John Toland. And that, yeah. I'm going to have to take that book down off the shelf here for the podcast here soon, but I, cause we're getting into that time. The book No Man's Land talks a lot about 1918 and that's its main focus. And it gets to like the very end of the war with the negotiations between the Allies and the Germans. And I bet it will cover the reasoning for 11 o'clock in there. I listened to it on audiobook about a year or two ago. So I don't remember specifically if it's covered in there, but
I think I would have had it like 2 weeks after it started.
Oh yeah.
I gotta ask you a question because I know All Quiet on the Western Front, we were talking about how machine gun scene really upsets you now and me as well, because it really showed, you know, not like 10 or 11 making it through, but nobody making it through.
Yeah.
And I had to wonder, Well, I looked up, when was the machine gun made? And you go, 1911. And the generals had to know, because they probably would have tested it on something living out in a field before the war. So they knew what was going on. So somebody must have said, well, let's send these 60,000 troops against these machine guns and see what really happens. And then well, the crazy thing is, when they got all mowed down, the Germans said, okay, now let's send our 60,000.
Right.
So explain to me that logic, and also explain to me what a killing zone is.
Okay. So I think the thing with the machine guns in 1914 was that, yes, they were new weapons. Much like hand grenades were in their infancy. The airplane was in its infancy. But all these weapons were new. And even though, like, these generals, you know, British, French, Belgian, Germans, like, they may have known about them, Russians. Even though these generals may have known about them, I don't think they knew, particularly with the machine gun, like, just how powerful and deadly it was.
You think? Wouldn't they have learned that in the Civil War? Ask a Native American about the Gatling gun. I would have thought that, you know. No, I think they wanted to test their fun toys.
No, I don't think they paid attention. I mean, I think I know that Europe, some European powers did send military personnel over here to come over to watch the Civil War, to observe and to see, you know, if they could glean any new tactics from what we were doing. I don't remember who made this quote. I believe it was a Prussian officer, but he came back to Germany and was like, talking about our Civil War, was like, there's nothing to learn from the Americans. It's just two mass conscript armies slaughtering each other. And
that would pretty much say it.
It's funny that he said that, because like the Civil War, the two big symbols of the American Civil War were the musket and the trench. You know, fast forward 50 years and, you know, the big symbols of World War One are going to be the machine gun and the trench.
You know, it reminds me of a scene, I'll go back to a movie, in Caligula with Peter O'Toole. There's a scene where Caligula executes all his foes, buries them in sand with only their heads sticking out. And then he's got this chariot that has a spinning scythe on it. And you just go, that's the same thing, only 2,000 years earlier.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. It was a new weapon. Nobody really understood, like, just how destructive they were, you know? And I seem to recall that, like,
the killing zone now.
Yeah. So the killing zones were like the, particularly the Germans, they would set up their barbed wire in such a way that they would leave lanes open in the barbed wire field. So they would lay out like a big field of it. And then but they would leave like a gap in it, right? Or they would shape it in such a way that they would drive you into a certain area. And that's
like cattle to the slaughter.
Yeah. Yeah. So they would drive, you know, their enemies into a certain area where their machine guns were already sighted. And then it was basically you just had to open fire and you would cut.
Triangulated kind of.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's another new weapon I want to ask you about in World War One that I think you probably can relate to, the tank.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that was oh, no, that won't work. That won't work. And then the Germans afterward going, hey, man, that really worked. Let's get these tractors for World War II and modify them. So tell me about the tank.
Yeah, well, I mean,
inside experience.
So that's another weapon, you know, it was developed after World War I very, you know, relatively quickly throughout 1915, and then introduced fairly prematurely on the battlefield in 1916. Like, I mean, these things tended to break down like crazy. But the tank, you know, originally it was going to be called a land ship, which I'm really glad they didn't look at.
I like that.
Yeah, but if I don't think it would be so cool to be like, you know, like, well, Mike, like, what'd you do in the army? Like, oh, I was a
land. Well, you are a tanker, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. So I get to say, you know, I'm a tanker instead of a.
What'd you do in a tank?
A land shipper. So me,
did you drive?
Me personally, like my time in the service was I was on Abrams, the Abrams M1A1 main battle tank. I was a gunner, and then briefly a commander. You know, for like.
All right. So, were you claustrophobic? And thank you again.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't. And I'll tell you. And members of my crew, they could probably back it up if you were to ask them. Like, most of the time, what I did in the gunner's hole was sleep. So.
Okay. Now, this will be a stretch. Maybe. How do you compare that experience to what it was like with the first tankers?
Oh, okay. So that's
conveniences. I know the Abrams is pretty, in terms of tanks, is a pretty deluxe tank.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, a lot of the I think like the spirit of the old tanks like still exists. Like now that I think about it, like of course the Abrams is much much safer. Okay. We had, like, for example, in the Abrams, we had a lot of like safety guards in place to keep stuff from like, if like a shell was banging around the inside of the turret, you know, you wouldn't get hit. The ammunition was stored away from the crew, and it had, the ammunition was stored in a separate compartment behind blast proof doors. And if they were to cook off, there are blow off panels on the top of the turret that would just direct the
see, I keep thinking, like a World War II tank is like a big metal container with wheels on it, like a basic box with a steering wheel, and you got ammunition and all sorts of stuff lying all over the floor.
Yeah. So this, you know, the Abrams is very different. So like it's designed to protect the crew. And to still be lethal on the battlefield. So we had a lot of that, and we had a lot of like protection. And of course, the coveralls we wore were flame retardant. You know, we had we called them CVC, combat vehicle crewman helmets. You know, so it padded with ear protection and everything. So we had all, you know, it's a vastly different experience than the first tankers in the BEF. Those tanks were, of course, they were slow, you know, like average, like 4 miles an hour speed. I mean, you could outwalk these things.
I'm staying behind one.
Yeah.
I'm not even going to stick my head out.
Yeah. People. So, you know, when you're thinking of the tank, you're thinking of that one that's shaped like a rhombus, and that's your mark, your Mark 5, yeah. Mark 6 and stuff like that. So those first British tanks, like, people sometimes ask, like, why didn't they have a turret? Why were the guns on the side? Well, in the middle was the big engine block, right? So that you couldn't put a turret on top of it. So the engine, everybody, you had like this engine block, and everybody operated around it. So you had the gunners on the side, you had the men who steered. So you would have one guy steer the right track, another guy steer the left track. You had the driver and the commander up front. And then the you know, again, like the gunners on the side, and it was large, rather large crews, and no protections. Like the engine was like this like red hot mass, right, like 2 feet away from you. And you know, like you get jumbled around, you know, and you get knocked off balance, and you put your hand out, you're gonna burn your hand on the engine block. You know, it was that sort of thing. Fumes. There was the exhaust didn't work correctly, or wasn't very well designed. So the inside would fill up with exhaust a lot. Like the guys would be throwing up, or passing out, or throwing up and passing out, or, you know, it was hot.
It was scary. The scary is this was probably considered a good assignment as opposed to being outside with a gun.
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of safety, like the Abrams is like, you know, like light years ahead.
I was also thinking comparing the, because when you develop new weapons on the battlefield, it kind of reminds me in the weird way of the B-24 in World War II. They got this new airplane that's got a fuel tank in the center, and you got, it's just, you know, I would think on a tank with no armor, one bullet gets in and it's just gonna ricochet around, or man.
Well, I mean, the first tanks, like, they were like generally bulletproof. The Germans, they did develop an anti-tank rifle, which was like just a
bigger bullet.
Just a bigger bullet. And it was like an infantry rifle, but like, you know, one that like, I don't know, man, like, I can't think of that, like a giant would fire, you know? And I guess when whatever unlucky German soldier got to fire this massive rifle, I think it would generally like break their shoulders, like just the recoil.
But like I said, Germans, and that was considered a good assignment.
right. But the Germans, they, you know, their first encounter with tanks, they, the guys on the ground who were on the receiving end of the first tank attack, like they genuinely panicked and fled. But, you know, the Germans very quickly learned to adapt. Like their 77 millimeter field gun, you know, that they used, their artillery, they would just, you know, rather than fire it at an angle, you would just, you aim it directly at the tank.
Right. And Germans, they didn't really have reflective armor or any of that as they developed.
No. And of course, like a solid artillery barrage would you know, coming down on the tank would take those out. And then guys who were close, the Germans also developed, I mean, they had this tactic anyways of like a lot of their stick grenades, rather than just have one stick grenade, they would have like, oh my God, like 10 of them all taped together, tied to one fuse. And they would just, you know, you would have to be pretty brave to do this, but they would run up to the tank and like put it under this mass of grenade. Yeah.
You sort of walk up to the tank because they're only going 4 miles an hour. You don't want to pass it.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And, you know, they would always, you know, that's the one way that, you know, those.
And the big, I was thinking, you know, with the big treads, because of the trenches, they probably had to be designed to, you know, tip in and then tip out.
So that was the thing, you see this, the British tank, and it's, you know, shaped like a, again, like a rhombus. And you're like, what a weird shape, with the track goes all the way, you know, around it. And that's exactly to be able to cross the trenches. Cause it would come in and drop down and then like, you know, dig itself out and keep on going.
See, this is why I love talking with you or listening to your podcast. Cause I only just thought of that by talking to you right now. And that's what makes conversation and history so much, is when you take the opinions sort of out of it, you know, like good guy, bad guy, and just observe history as a whole. That's kind of what I do now. I compare, but you were talking about trench warfare. I was thinking, you know, like the machine gun was developed. What was it called? The trench sweeper, just to go in there and then trenches got so crazy. I wanted to talk a little bit about mining, like Beneath Hill 60 is a great movie.
Yeah.
And I know when in our talks, when you were on the battlefields in Europe, you got to see where the hill blew up.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, when you closed your eyes, what did you feel? How did, you know, just tell me about that experience, because I didn't get to go and I wanted to, but tell me.
So, you know, I mean, first, like, I am going to get you there, man. We have to get you there, because we have to see, we have to get you to the spot where your dad served during World War II. And we're going to get that done here.
And there are easier hills there.
Yeah. And we'll drive that part. But just to go back, like, so there's like a cool feeling when I go to the Meuse region of, you know, where Verdun and where the American, the Meuse-Argonne offensive took place, like, there is something about that region. It is, I find it stunningly beautiful. It's also really unchanged. So the villages were, many of the villages, you know, were severely damaged or completely destroyed. But post-war, the the French nationals returning to their homes. Like, they told the French government, like, you will rebuild this village. You will rebuild it exactly as it was.
Oh, man, I love that. Only the French. Only the, that's such zoning. Out here where I live, it's like, I live out in the country, and they'll go, let's move out of the country and get a zero lot line. No, that's just...
Oh,
that's
so... So it's really cool. And a lot of these villages, I mean, like, so that, you know, everything is new, you know, it's a century old, but, you know, there are still traces. Like, there's like the church in Cunel, that is like, you walk around to the back of the church and the wall is peppered with bullet holes all over it. And you see that everywhere. Downtown Verdun.
They probably used the brickwork that had fallen by the wayside next to it. And then use that to rebuild too.
Yeah. I mean, in some cases, yeah. But like, but going to that region, it does feel like, oh man, it's a definite draw, like for the Verdun battlefield. Like, I...
Almost like, spiritual?
Kind well, of so you're asking about... Around. You're asking about like how I felt it at like the site of the mining warfare. I will say... nothing there other than like a reverence and respect for what happened there. I will say, like, I do remember my first visit to the Verdun battlefield. Like, I was still in the service, and we drove from Germany down to Verdun, and then we were going on our way to Normandy. Or it was the reverse. I forget. It was 20 years ago. But when we were at Verdun, I mean, I will say it was a day in June. It was June of like 2001. And a beautiful summer day. And we were standing in front of the ossuary at Douaumont, you know, on the Verdun battlefield. And the ossuary itself, I mean, there's pictures of it that I have on my podcast page on Facebook and everything. And but it looks like the hilt of a sword, like driven into the ground, you know. And then in front of it, there's a French military cemetery with 15,000 Frenchmen buried there, you know. And the ossuary itself contains the remains of some 130,000 French and German troops, like completely unknown at this point.
Yes, missing in action.
Yeah. I do remember that day, like visiting that cemetery, and it was, you know, like my first time there, and we're, you know, like walking around and everything. And I said to my friends, I was like, guys, it's like, check it out real quick. And they just stopped, and we stopped talking. And I was like, there's no birds. It's a beautiful day in the summer, and we're surrounded by woods. There's no birds in the sky. Like, everything was silent. And I do recall that time, like, I felt like I was being watched, you know, like something was like watching me while I was there.
You know, when I've been to a battlefield at Gettysburg,
mm-hmm.
Close your eyes. It's like not being watched for me, but in the presence of, you know, with all that emotion, and you just put your mind back 100 years and you're going, holy cow.
It's just, yeah. I couldn't do it.
I mean, as a soldier, towards the end, would you go over a trench going into machine gun fire knowing it was useless? God, what a hard order to obey.
Yeah, I imagine a lot of those guys like really didn't want to, but you know, that's the unfortunate part of being a soldier. Like it's kind of like the old saying, like yours is not to ask why, yours is but to do or die, you know. So like it's tough. Like I'm sure a lot of those guys, you know, went over the top, like saying like I really don't want to be the last one killed, but you know, unfortunately they had to do it, and a lot of them were killed, sadly.
Yeah. Well, go back to your impressions of Verdun. I was just going to say Vietnam. Sorry, kind of similar. Verdun. Mm-hmm. Get back to how.
Yeah. So one thing is like, man, being there for me, like being there in like when it's rainy and misty, Because that's, I mean, the American, the Meuse-Argonne battle was largely fought under rain. I mean, so it was a 47-day battle, and it rained for 43 of them. And so Verdun was also known for like a lot. I mean, it started in winter, it ended in winter, and then, you know, it was known for the mud, you know, so rain turned the battlefield into a quagmire and everything. And so if you're in the Meuse region, because of like how it's shaped, you know, geologically, like it's pretty prone to storms and weather. So if you're ever there, you get the fog, you get these days of like rain and you know, just raw cold days. Like, and when I'm there and we have those days like that, like I can, like, I'm almost waiting for like a column of doughboys to like march on the road, like in front of me, even though I'm driving in a car, like I'm waiting to like see them or to see someone like walk out in front of me, you know, like a French soldier or a German soldier. Like you just, I think like you do feel, I don't know if I'm looking into it too much, but I do feel like the weight of what has happened around in that area. I feel that like around me, you know.
Plus your personal experiences, I think you can relate to it so much. I mean, I've never experienced it, but I've grown up on military bases, and there's just I look at you, you got the buzz cut, you know, you carry that. People in the military, you know, end up with a different style, especially those folks that have served in combat. The only time they talk about combat is with another person that's been in combat. My dad was like that. So I have to learn about all this stuff from guys like you. And I really appreciate that. So now that I've carried on, go back to that blowing up of that hill real good.
Yeah. So that's that site is Vauquois, the Butte de Vauquois. So so this is interesting because like in 1914, the Butte de Vauquois, it was a solitary hill. It's unconnected to the other hills in the area. So it was a it was an important site. Like you wanted that high ground so that you could dominate the land around it. By 1918, with air warfare now much more well developed, holding a hill like the Butte de Vauquois was actually obsolete, like just 4 years later, you know. But in the time in 1914 and 15 and 16, so what happened is the French, you know, in their retreat south in the autumn of 1914, they abandoned Vauquois, like, and the Germans took it. The French then coming back after the Battle of the Marne, and you know, and then the line starts to gel into trench warfare. The French attack the hill. And what wound up happening over a few months was the French took half of the hill and the Germans took the other half. And there was the village of Vauquois was on top of it. It was a village of about, I think it was 168 residents. You know, so buildings, a couple of streets. Right. And so everybody dug in, and then infantry attacks became suicidal. Like you couldn't do it. So what happened is the French were like, why don't we dig under and just start blowing up the Germans from underneath them? And the Germans got the idea, you know, they got the same idea. And that's just how it was. Like on Vauquois, you didn't do infantry attacks. You held the line and you just, you know, of course there would be mortars and throwing of grenades and stuff like that. And but the biggest thing was that you held the line and just prayed to God that, like, you know, the ground under you wasn't gonna explode. And it was
fear from above, fear from below, and fear from
in front of you. So over the course of you know, throughout the war, that hill took 519 mine explosions. 300 of them were conducted by the French. The Germans, they did the biggest one. They packed 60 tons of Westphalit explosive into a mine shaft, 60 tons, and basically blew off the western side of the hill. Like So high.
Is that the video Peter Jackson used, the monster?
No, no. So, so Vauquois isn't as well known because it was a French and German battlefield. And the Americans came in basically like at the last minute. Like it was the Americans that captured the hill, but that's a whole other story. But so how I like to explain the hill is if you're watching the video form of this, like, so this was the hill, you know, and you had the village on top of it. At the end of the war, the hill looked like this. Like it's been like completely gouged out. Like and Vauquois, the pre-war Vauquois village, there's not a trace of it remains. Post-war Vauquois village was rebuilt, but at the bottom of the hill now, where it is today. Yeah, I think if I recall correctly, the Peter Jackson's film, like They Shall Not Grow Old, that mine explosion that they're showing, that's Hawthorne Crater, no doubt, on the Somme, which I've visited as well. Like that's also an impressive, massive hole in the ground.
Yeah. Beneath Hill 60, you know, it's Australians they bring into it, yeah. Miners. I was just thinking, these guys probably said, golly, I'll take any job to get me out of this mine over here in Australia. And then they go over there. But, I mean, they risk their lives. And I guess it's that old adage, we save lives by having to put fewer people in harm's way.
Right, but, right. Man,
that was a really quite a movie. And it talked about this thing where, towards the end of the war, they were running out of soldiers, so they would send white feathers in the mail to people that hadn't been conscripted.
Yeah,
and it was like, man, I just can't imagine.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that was back home and on the British home front. Like, that's how, you know, during wartime, like obviously war itself is an extreme act and, you know, emotions start to get extreme. And yeah, that's what some British men faced. And if they didn't sign up, you know, they'd have a white feather stuck on them, or sometimes like I've read of even like having them like shoved up their nostril and, you know, to purposely to hurt them as well. It was to show them off as cowards. Yeah, because by the end of the war, like Britain had to start conscripting men. They hadn't done that in the beginning.
You know, I was reading something, I guess just yesterday, or heard something in the Ukrainian war, Russians and Ukrainians, it's 200,000 in 9 months. And those numbers, to me, run akin to World War I in the same sort of neck of the woods.
Yeah, well, I think so. One thing is that the currently ongoing Russo-Ukrainian war, I think it'll be called in the books, is it's basically turned into a very unsexy, like World War One style artillery duel. And I say unsexy because of like how things are portrayed in the media. So like, you know, you do see the tanks and stuff. You know, and the destroyed apartment buildings and everything, but what's, you know, what's really happening is a grinding artillery battle out there on the front, and it's expensive. Like I say that in terms of like destruction, in terms of lives. Yeah, I don't doubt. Like I've read something that like what the sources I've heard have been that like 80,000 Russians have been killed at this point. Like, and I'm unaware of any Ukrainian figures because they hold those pretty close to the vest, you know, for security reasons. But yeah, it,
World War One changed that empire, you know,
yeah, the Russian,
and now it's just crazy being historians.
Yeah.
How that old adage, yeah, just repeats itself, and you're going, yeah.
Yeah. I think also what you're seeing too is like, you know, it's happening in Ukraine, and I even find myself falling into this, not a trap, but like just falling into this line of thought is like, where is the big decisive battle? Well, they're happening all the time. So in World War One, like, you know, the Germans invaded through Belgium and into France, and then came the Allied like counterpunch at the Marne. But like where, like you would have thought, like, okay, a massive battle, like let's go back to Waterloo. Like it was a smashing, you know, like defeat, and that's it. The war is, you know, that enemy has been vanquished. Like with the Marne, you know, the Germans, yeah, I mean, they suffered, they lost the battle and they suffered mass casualties everywhere, but they weren't out. They were like, well, you know, we still have troops to hold the line. And so what they did was they retreated and they dug in and the battles continued. And then, you know, you get battles like the Battle of the Somme, the Battle of Verdun, you get the battle, you know, Passchendaele, the British offensive there, and all of these battles go on for months and they're grinding out huge numbers of casualties. And it's like none of these are the knockout blow. What you have to do is you simply have to grind down your enemy, you know, before he grinds you down. You're seeing this, I think we're seeing the same thing in Ukraine, because in the beginning, you know, Russia went for that knockout blow on Kyiv and they got obliterated up on the northern front. And then, you know, throughout the spring, you know, they were grinding their way forward and the Ukrainians were trying to hold the line. And then right at the beginning of September, I believe that the much awaited Ukrainian counterattack came and they pushed the Russians back. You know,
you're talking and somebody asking a question, thinking, because from the media and YouTube, I keep thinking the Ukrainians are like a guerrilla warfare. But you're telling me they're holding lines. I didn't know anything about this.
Yeah, no. So this is, you know, pretty conventional warfare. Just it's almost like World War One, World War Two style warfare, just fought with incredibly advanced weaponry. So like just to finish my thought, like so you're seeing the Ukrainians push the Russians back. You're seeing maneuver warfare and you know the taking and retaking of ground and like. And even though a lot of the news is like breathless and like wow, you know, like, well, the Russians are beaten now. Like, unfortunately, you know, as we saw in World War One and World War Two, like armies can take these massive hits. And if they're big enough and well supplied, like they can keep going. So that's, you know, right now, just a couple of days ago, Russian forces have retreated from Kherson and a large amount of the Kherson Oblast. That's the province. And they're retreating behind the Dnipro River. And, you know, is it a shattering defeat? Like, yeah, it's pretty bad. I mean, it certainly looks bad. But again, like, is the Russian army completely routed and are they collapsing and everything? Like, no, they're still hanging in there, and the Ukrainians are still hanging in there too, and just grinding that line back, so that's what we're seeing. It's modern warfare. There are no like knockout blows. I mean, if you even look to our Civil War, Gettysburg was the high watermark of the Confederacy, and it was where the Union decisively beat the rebels, but that war still went on for another 2 years.
And instead of the machine gun, you had the Springfield rifle.
Yeah.
So you know, this has been a great, I originally wanted to talk to you about movies and go through them all, and then I knew we would get into this conversation. That once again, I learned a bunch from you. I honestly thought the Ukrainians were guerrilla warfare, because all the videos you see is, look, here comes the Jeep and it shot out a rocket. And look, it shot down that plane and then they drive off.
Yeah. No, it's conventional. It's force on force.
I want to get together and talk some more. I hope this worked for you, but
yeah, man. Yeah.
And cut out my rambling. And more of you, because
no, that's fine, really, man. Yeah,
thank you for your service.
No worries. Yeah,
and we'll go to Europe, and
yes. Yeah,
my dad, was 21 when he was he survived, and they didn't know where to put him, so they made him head MP of Occupied Paris at 21. So you can imagine, but they're all like Peter Jackson. They're all young old people.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the amazing thing is it, you know, and that's something that always gets me with the military is like how much responsibility you're given, and you're so young. Like I remember when I came home and I was trying to put like my first resume together as a civilian, and I was working with my cousin, and I was just listing everything that I had been responsible for, like in the military, and you know, like I was responsible for that tank. That tank was, you know, $3 million, and I was also
never talk about it. I just found out you were a tank commander. I had to squeeze that out of you. You were, you know,
I mean, it was brief. It was like, you know, I was a tank commander for like a month or two, and I will say, it was the highest position I got. So I will always like try to throw that in there.
Commander is like. That's a really good, well, yeah, even being an enlisted guy is a real,
yeah,
you know, when I see him, yeah, I see the Vietnam veteran, and I told you I saw that World War II veteran the other day, and you go up and talk to him and you just break down.
And I mean
is very special,
yeah.
And even as a kid when I got this Iron Cross, and I once again I want to thank you for getting together. Thank you for everything.
Yeah,
I don't know where course, any, commander, but I'm sure it was knee deep in the big muddy. So,
yeah. We'll have to talk about movies the next time, man. That'll be good.
All right. Thanks again, and I'm proud to be a patron, and we will get to Europe. Yes. And I will close my eyes on that battlefield.
Yes, and we're gonna do that, and let's do it 2023, man. All right, I'll stop recording.